I'm Peter Robinson. I've been doing in the area, and she followed me. For my rationalization, so I just waited and turned up. And came home one day and said, when I can see this name off? I let him write anyway. I said, I don't know. He said, well, he's wrong. And I said, I don't know, that's all I can tell. But it worked, you see. And that was the beginning of my realizing one of my defects of character was the fact that I always had to explain to people what I meant. Without knowing what I meant, I used to, in my explanation, I'd say, okay, they sometimes change my mind, right, miss? You know, because it just worked out that way. And I haven't made a lot of misery and unhappiness in my life by not having to explain anything to anybody. You know, when you have to explain your own existence, or why you should be happy, you know. That's another thing they did to me when I was new in Al-Anon. The first Al-Anon speaker I ever heard was about, oh, he started to talk about saying, I'm a fan, I love alcohol. And I wanted to knock her down, actually, because I figured that fuck one was bad enough to brag about it. No more than I could take. And so at the next meeting, they always asked the newcomer or whoever. And I was a brand new newcomer for a long time. But they always asked me how you enjoy meeting. And I was very honest. They said, come on, I own very, very sincerely that I really believe someone should drive to talk. And because of that one honest little second in my heart, those females gave me an assignment. I was supposed to go home, take a hand, say, hey, I love you. That's all. I said, you're kidding. That's what you have to do. And I was so scared you didn't have to do anything, you know. It took me 3 months before I actually did it, and I didn't do that as I wanted to. I did, but it kind of worked at that meeting when those females answered that check. And I didn't know how to talk to you, I had no answer, see? And I'm more like him because I had actually seen him at that meeting that disappeared, never saw him again, and I didn't know that, though. And I didn't want to take any unnecessary chances, so when I asked the light was off, I reached over and I took his hand, and I said, Eddie, I love you. And he said, let's get a bit. What the hell do we do now? And I didn't want to lie to most romantic answers, but I learned something that night that I couldn't have found out anyway. No matter how many times he tells me, no matter how many ways he tries to prove to me how he feels about me, if I'm not in the mood to listen, he's wasting his time. Because I got something back here. And that little plot goes off occasionally and says, you let that sir get away with that after what he did you in 1943. You know, because I hold a grudge for all time, you know. So there is no way, unless I can crawl into his head and figure out what's going on, that he can prove to me how he feels about me. But at the very same time, I found out for the first time how I felt about him. I found out that with my father, with my husband, and even today with my son, it's not that I don't love them. It's that I don't like what they're doing. And I have a right to dislike what they're doing. What I don't have a right to do is insist that they do it my way, so that I have a comfortable feeling, supposedly, because they are minding me. I have control of them. I've had to learn to take them as God, and let them be. Just the fact that they get so weird and bizarre, and he still drives me up along on a regular basis. But tonight I'm not minding for that, you know. And I have people say, I thought we came out on that night, straight now, not in one ever straight out. Mine goes up and out and out there. The only change is that since I've been on, I get right in the car instead of getting in the cab. And that's pretty much the way it was. I just brought what I used to, because I didn't feel like me. And I can let him do and say whatever he's wanted to do and say, and I don't have to worry about it at all. I don't care about it. I never answer a statement. If he said, that phone's sure shining up tonight. Sorry to me, I'm only dark, but if he'll know that, I don't. See, maybe I've been crazy. Yeah. Because this is one of his little methods for getting me into conversation. See, and usually I end up talking myself while he goes up as a time where he's going. Because I might not know maybe 4 or 5 minutes ago, then trust myself. And why is it, and what'd you say? That gets me in trouble. Because then he tells me what he's thinking about. He was mumbling to himself the moment when I went to take like a puff, and I said, oh, did they say something? And he said, oh, no, I was just saying, blonde shirt needs to be cut. And they were still out then. And so that's all he did. And he went off to the office, and when Butch got up, I said, you saw a mission at the salon. I'll be cut. And I was all sitting. And the book ran Bill, and he said, Dad, said for you to cut the lawn. And I wanted to know before he got home that night, God, it's not pretend. It looked like it didn't pop, because everybody and everybody else and trusted to do it with salt, you know. And when he came home, he said, what the hell happened to the lawn? And I said, I don't know. So he cut, I guess, you know. And he's never talked about the lawn, because that's easy, and everything else, you know. But once I started to talk to yourself, my life last year, we made a trip from California to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I don't think he said, didn't miss one another. He walked away, but not to a shot, you know. He just fumbled. And we just went along, and it was hard to step by. I don't know that it worked out at the time, but we ended up in Kansas City, and we were playing golf with a girlfriend of mine, and she and I were riding in the cart, and Eddie was walking. And she said to me, when Eddie said something to you, and I said, no, did. She said, he died. And I said, no, you heard him talking. You did not hear him talking to me. And that was all of a sudden. When I got home, there was a letter there from Jason, and said, what do you mean he was talking? But he wasn't talking to you. And so I called on the phone, and she called Alma, too. And she married one of those. Anyhow, all these things are things that turned out in the fourth and fifth. You know, being able to become acquainted with myself. That's quite a chore. Because I did not turn out to be at all like I thought I was. I didn't turn out to be, brilliant. I'm not brilliant, and I always thought I was. I'm a little bit of a lesson, but didn't know anything about the most important things there are in this world today, and that's me. Because I truly believe I am the most important person in my life. As long as I continue feeling that way, I'm able to do things for other people. Because I do it because I want to, not because I have to. And that was important for me to learn. It made a lot of difference as far as my relationship with my family. As I told you yesterday, maybe it was this morning, I had to use both traditions and the steps in order to recover, and still using it. But I also, the first tradition, the credit for allowing me to become a member of my own family. Because the first tradition says that recovery is the greatest number depends on unity. And I always had unity and unison confused. I thought if I said, when dinner's over, we're going to do so-and-so, and nobody objected, that meant they agreed. That's not what I meant. It meant they knew that if they disagreed, we were never going to get through with dinner. That's what I meant. See, and then it would go over and it would just feel like they'd never been there. And when I got to them, I said to them one day, I advised them to do this to me. After all, I asked them, why did they treat me this way? And she sent me a silly question. Have you ever asked them, or have you always told them? She said, don't look up the word unity. And the definition of the word unity is the ability to disagree agreeably. I knew that before. I thought that if you agreed with me, that meant that we had unity. But that's not what it means. And so I had to take the label, mother, off, and allow myself to become a member of my own family. And it worked out right. I heard a kid in Alton one time say, if you thought to be a friend, you must have done something right. And that I just as a little sort of gimmick to help me get along with my kids. Because mine are not perfect kids. You know, I have one daughter, I very rarely mention this, because it is not really my story, it's her story. But she had a problem with pills, and I did the same thing that I'd done with Eddie. Only I rationalized it was different. See, I had been out on and so forth and so on, and I used to say to Wilma, to leave her husband and want to easily follow by our hair now. But child, how? And I desert the child. I was trying to help her. I was trying to help me. She was embarrassing to me. She was a repeat of what my father had in me, and what my husband had been to me, and now what my father was to me. And I bent over backwards trying to help her, so that she would stop doing what she was doing, so that people now on AA and our circle friends and everything else wouldn't know that I had been a terrible mother, that she was driven to this. Now, that makes sense to you. That's how I used to rationalize things, you know. And I remember one time when I went down to the day, she never had to worry about anything. We were divided with the daughter. She didn't call me at a certain time on Saturday night. I called the sheriff's office. And that's when it would be necessary for me to have my attorney call and find out where my daughter was. Say, honey, but maybe I had my head drinking, you know. And one time I went down to the day, she stood right in the middle of the sheriff's office and put her arms like this, and she said, I refuse to go unless you bail out my plans. You know I did? Because she was embarrassed. I had not been sharing that. That means that I had an attending. I heard it. But I never came right out and said, how was bothering me? What was going on? Well, I shared with the rest of my family. I still went back to playing a game in the program as well as when I was home. And finally, I got a meeting on the Blue Beach, and I was out to hear with her and her and her son. Meeting a gal who has gone out recently. She came up to me, and she said, hey, I want to ask you one question. And I said, okay. She said, do you love your daughter? Or are you determined to kill with violence? And the first time that I began to recognize what I was doing, not for her, but to her. Because, see, I was killing her by allowing her to use my defective character, which was pride, to destroy her. When she ended up in jail, I tell you, I almost went nuts. Because I would go to the jail and I'd tell off that darn thing, you know, even worse than that when she I'd tell off that sick, you know, and I was sitting in this country and I didn't have police recognize the carrying a gun and all this stuff. They should have done about a fucking thing. But they made me pull it out and I would go inside and all the time I was thinking to myself, what am I doing here? Why would she do this to me? Put me through this torment. And she'd come down from upstairs and we'd talk between this laugh on the telephone and she'd cry on her side and I'd cry on my side. But all that in question, why? What am I doing here? And finally, I was sitting there waiting for her and I'd get to the place where I almost didn't go down there, you know, I got away from the deputies. I did one of my Christmas shopping there that year, because they made beautiful things in their ceramic, you know, things. Some of the best homes weren't going to be nice, but they were still brand. But they were mud. I was sitting there, and they had a bitch in the bench, and there was a bench behind me, and I heard this female behind me, and she was just loving like nobody's business. I mean, I didn't quite know that she was kind of noisy. Curiosity talked to one of my assets, and just for the heck of it, I turned around to look, and behind me sat an Alan gal from me in Lee, California. And she took one look at me, and she said to me, then Eddie, what are you doing here? So it was just absolutely out of the question that I would be so stupid as to the brand. But that was the day that I knew why I was there. That was the day that I knew that regardless of what it had happened in my life, I'm very sure to you, I'm cheating myself. Because I don't have a chance of getting over some of these things that can drive me out of the wall unless I have the freedom to let you know how I feel. And to let you know there are these things that do happen. No matter how hard you try, practice principles of discovery. That's what principles are for. It's not to keep from getting into the hole, it's to help you get out of the hole. Not something that I had come to terms with. It's kind of a funny side to actually have just only interest in sex every year. And I always kind of felt responsible because, see, I wouldn't go to court with her. I'd always gone to court with her before. And she went for it by herself, and I wouldn't even send a lawyer, so she had to leave her own case, and she didn't know for years, so I felt it was my fault. But then she had 3 months, and she decided she might get a job, and she never knew how to do anything. She turns all to jail. And so she told me she was going to go over and take this job, and I said, you know how to make that job. You don't know how to do it. And she said, say, mother, I just told her I'm in jail. And this was the kind of job where you do key work. You know what that is? I didn't think it was the kind of job she should have. The point of it, it's better than not to let her go. Despite me, she went over. And when she and her girlfriend came back, and I said, did you get the job? And she said, we're going to call up an interview. And I said, oh, did you fill out the application? Okay. She said, I guess so. I said, well, what do you look down for experience? And she said, civil brand. I said, oh, you mean to tell me that you told them your experience came from jail? And she said, well, that's where I learned the soul. I said, well, forget it. We'll never get that job. And 2 days later, they called and asked for an interview. Now I went over. And she came back. She said, I got a job. And I said, you got the job? And she said, yes. And I used to lie to them. And she said, no, I don't. She said, when he read over my application, he came to my experience and said, civil brand. And he said, civil brand, I don't think I recognize that action house. And so I said, well, it's the LA County. He said, oh, well, I do work for the county. You can do the job. He didn't know civil brand was the one jail. And he thought it was another kind of profession out, and she got a job, because she was honest. If she had followed my advice, she would have put out the murder door or some of the reverie exclusive places. See, because losing the glandular was another one of the defective characters that I had to ask God to remove. I had become who I am and data. And I haven't had time, you know, just being me. I despise people all the time that they're kind of smart. My love, they do. You know, I'm smart for what they think. But they ask me to tell them the truth. I'm not that smart. But it's just using the principles of this program. I'm sure to somebody I don't remember who it was. It's very difficult for me to departmentalize this way of life. Me and one ball of wax. And it's difficult for me to take out, except by remembering certain instances that happened over a period of time, what it's all about, you know, to go back and remember, because right now, usually, unless a big thing comes up, I almost do automatically what I practice to do, one day at a time, over and over again. And the only thing I have to be sure of is that I keep it in segments I can handle. Somebody asked me earlier today if there was a formula for Al-Anon that would help, you know, something that was very easy to remember to keep on the right track. And I asked them if they had ever read the big book of Al-Anon, and they said no. And I said, well, that's where you go to find the answer. And she said, it's a big book, okay? And I said, yes. But at the end of chapter 5, it said, made clear three pertinent ideas. A, the alcoholic would not enter our own lives. B, that probably no human power could rebrowse, and C, that I could and would be resolved. And I, the only decision you have to make after you get thoroughly acquainted with the ABC of the edge, have to this: are you God? And if you're not, then you take your hands off. Because the power that runs my life today is the power greater than myself that I choose to call God. And that's pretty well sums up the 4th, 5th, and 6th. So that too are all about as far as I'm concerned. It makes it a lot easier, I guess, to look back than it does look forward. My hindsight's always been a little bit better than before. But we'll get to the part of the steps that I really had a lot of fun with. Well, it did turn out to be fun. But when I knew that I'd make a list of all persons I had harmed, there weren't very many. And I cannot be mentally quite along this. And then I had to make amends to them all. I was a very perfect person when I got down on my first letter, amend letter, that I made several copies of. I was just going to write names in there. I'll use them, you know. And it was so sarcastic that my son burned. Because before you got to the end of the letter, it was your fault, you know. And I realized, we'll get to that later on. Now, I think I got to stand much angry, so it should be about 2 o'clock, right? Yeah. You're free.
This is the end of session 3. Start of session 4.
Right. Any more announcements? I love announcements. Mom's in the door about a gum crab mother of. In Southern California, they usually have a meat tenderizer. And I've always thought it was apropos, you know, they get a thing. Why apples? They love that meat tenderizer. And I presume you're all having a good time. I am. I'll tell you that, darn sure. I went over to my room after lunch today, or after the session today, to kind of commiserate with 7th, or with the 8th and 9th, because I have a problem with that on my today, you know. Primarily because I think it's the way it's written. Made a list of all persons I harm, and being willing to make amends to them all. And I, as I have over time again, I'm one of those people who quarrel with words. Harm to me meant hurt. And I could honestly look back and see that I had hurt anybody. But my sponsor was very helpful to me when she started pointing out that there were different ways to hurt people. I was thinking of physical hurt, because that was an easy out for me. You see, I never physically hurt anybody, so I could legitimately skip that step if it became necessary. But I didn't stop to think of people that I harmed like my kids. Mine were not so much sins of commission as mine were sins of omission, or hurts of omission. When I would not do something that I could do to help somebody because of whatever fantasy or whatever reason that in my mind I didn't want to. It was a way of getting even with them without them knowing I was getting even with them. You know what I mean? I think sometimes about my dad when he used to like to go with me someplace. He's always wanted to go with me. And I don't know why, you know, because I used to say to him, I want to take him. First thing you want to do is stop and get a drink. And I don't want to take him. And then he looked at me long enough and I take him. And I knew that he was one of those people that had to make frequent pit stops. I don't happen to have to do that for myself because Eddie is responsible for me having probably one of the best set of kidneys in the world. I can never afford to go to the restroom because Eddie has to wait for me. So I developed a method of being able to go for hours, you know, like a camel. And one of the things I thought about was the number of times I took my father someplace when he was afraid to ask me to stop. And I knew he wanted me to stop and I purposely wouldn't. Now, I don't really understand what I'm trying to say, but these were the kind of things that I did that made it necessary for me to become willing to make amends for the things that I had done. I also had to go back over and realize there were a lot of things I had done as far as my husband was concerned. Things that that really could have done a little bit differently, probably done a little better, and made life a little easier. But I did do for the very same reason that I used to torment my son in my own way. And that was because it was my way of getting even with him for what I thought he had done to me. All these things are things that the woman brought up to me that meant harming some other individual. And so I ended up quite a long list of people I had harmed. And I was willing to make amends to them all. And as I kind of told you before the last session, I fixed up a sort of a format that said I was sorry, but I didn't say before. And I didn't say I wasn't going to do it again. And I didn't say anything. Might have, you know. But I was willing to let her know that I was aware of the fact that I had done things that I shouldn't have done. And Will took a look at the letter and she said, that'll never do. And I said, why not? And she said, because you're still playing a game with her online. Until you can honestly, willingly go to these individuals, or be willing to go to these individuals, and tell them exactly what it is and ask them to forgive you, you're not going to have any peace of mind. They probably have long since forgotten and maybe don't even know that you did any of these things. And when you go to meet them, you go not for their sake, but for your sake, to get them off your back, to make a clear path so that you can walk through life without always looking over your shoulder and wondering, when will they realize that this is what I did? You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the time I was playing the golf tournament and a girl in the fixing behind got a hole in one, and a wheeled-in bottle of champagne was about, well, that's beer every time, so it was about that big. Sort of like fish story, from sea. But anyhow, I helped her drink it because I didn't want her to get drunk. Then I got in my car, and I drove 40 miles, and I was like, Eddie was back to my house, turned in my driveway, missed the driveway completely, and went through the fence. And that covered me up like that, you know, oh my God, Eddie is going to kill me. Well, he wasn't going to kill me, that. But I didn't know he was going to find out that I was capable of doing what he had done several times. And that did go through the fence and back run in the car. So I called Sully and I knew that fixed fences. And I asked him to come over right away and fix the fence, he didn't. And then I took the car down to where we usually got it fixed. And I said, well, how long is it going to take you to fix this car? And he said, about 3 days. And I said, no, I have to have done before Eddie gets home tonight. And so he straightened it out, he painted it, and he said, 5 days, don't let me. And I said, it's still there. And I went home, and to all intents and purposes, I should have been completely at ease. I had redone everything that I had lost up. And to all intents and purposes, I might never have found out that I had done it. Except I began to wait. See, where maybe one of the neighbors would say to him, we sure take your driveway, didn't you? Or one of the kids say, did you know mother had to take the car that I had fixed? And so, as I usually did when I was cracked, I called my sponsor. And she said to me, well, I think you better tell him. And I said, tell him. I just got through doing all this stuff so that he wouldn't find out. And she said, you can do what you want to. But if you don't tell him, you're going to spend the rest of your life waiting for him to find out. And that's what's going to make you uncomfortable. Not the fact that you want your fence, not the fact that you're at the front end of the car, but the fact that you are giving somebody else a power over your life that you can't control. And that kind of reminds me of the time that when I first came to Alan and they said, be good to yourself. They ever said that? Well, you say good to yourself, you need that in shopping. And I did. And I bought this dress one day, it was on sale. And I didn't have sale to sale. I buy it, but I don't know, but I buy it even 50. You know, I'm just was open box shopper. I get my own son out of this dress. I paid money for you, but but I thought it would really no stand out. But on the way home, the dress was exciting, and I began to think I didn't pay that much for that dress. And so I talked to myself on the way home, and I explained to me that I just asked Eddie how much he thought I had bought. And we got within what I thought was a reasonable price. I said, you know, every time. And that's what I did. I just let him guess until I got close to what it was. And I figured he'd give me that much. And out of household money, I'll be able to get the difference. And I'm big for the red, and then he'll never know that I'm a sucker again. So it didn't work out that way. I got his money all right, but I had to buy shoes, and I had to buy a purse, and I had to buy several other things to go with his dress. And the first bill came in, I almost fainted when I saw and realized what I paid for that dress. And so I put that away, and I'd save the money there. And this went on for 3 months. I finally got a bill of stamp. You better order it. And I was in trouble, so I called Bill, and I told her what was going on, and she said to me, just like she had got the car, she said, Bill, I guess you're gonna have to tell her. I said, tell her, I can't tell her. Sure enough, I've been lying to her. I can't tell her. She's good one. If you threw her another way, it's all right with me, but if I were you, I'd help. So I have kids in bed, and I fixed a knife dinner for Eddie, and soft light, and candles, whole bit, you know, just I used to entice him while he was drinking. And he knew there was something wrong, you know, because my change of attitude. And when I thought he was in a mellow mood, I said to him, hey, you know that dress I bought? Now I know I hate the dress. I wore it, they gave it to me. Because every time I put it on, it reminded me once more of all this mess I've got myself into. And I said, remember that dress I bought? He said, yes. And I said, well, I didn't exactly tell you the truth about it. He said, yes, I know. And I said, what do you mean you know? I had been going through my dresser drawers, because that's what he used to do to him. I'd go through his pocket, through his watch, through his dresser drawers, see everything. Okay. And then I figured he must do the same to me, you know? He said, hey, I can go through your dresser drawers. I just thought that. And I said, but how could you know I did tell you the truth if you'd go through my dresser drawers? And he said, you know those things that hang on the sleeve when you buy something? And I said, yes. And he said, you forgot to take them off. And he had on for 3 months. I had lied to him about the dog on dress. Well, that made him mad. Because I thought the least he could have done, I always told him when he was lying. And I thought the least he could have done is reciprocate by being lying and telling me that I was lying. And instead, I called my son and I told her how terrible he'd been to me. And how I had done all this stuff, made it nice so I could tell him about this. And he had to do it. Just I told him that I was lying. And she said to me, well, I hope you learned a lesson from this. And I said, well, I did. She said, what is it? And I said, well, we don't get to it. Take the best of But these were some of the things that that I did that are on my mind. Now, maybe I was wrong about putting them on, but I had to make amends to myself before I made amends to anybody else. Because I couldn't have done to you the things that I had done to myself. But I got the nice step, making great amends to other people whenever possible, except to do so good to their others. That's tough. That's one of those where the person that you hurt the most, you care the most about, and usually is closest to you. And it makes it awfully difficult to go to somebody and make amends like to my husband or to my children or somebody else. And I led a retreat just like this. And I heard the retreat master say, to make an amends to a contract means to change that contract. And if you can, in your innermost self, admit to God, yourself to another human being, that you will never again do this thing which has caused harm to another human being, you have made amends. Because this whole program, this whole way of life, to me today, is based on a change in attitude. And an attitude, I believe, is what the 7th and the 8th and 9th are all about. To change what I used to be like to what I can be like today on a daily basis, if I practice the principles of this fellowship and this program. I didn't know what a change of attitude really was, to tell you the truth. I know that it sounds like there were a lot of things I didn't know. There were a lot of things I didn't know. But those things I didn't know were things I spent my life dodging. I knew what they were. I just didn't accept that at all. But, I went to a meeting time and I was new, and I found something. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't a big deal, but I was going to lay on to make it get better. And I was late as usual, and when I got in there, everybody was already seated around the table. And the gal leading the meeting, well, no, it was not, but she knew what she was doing. And she had her meeting all planned, and so I knew I was going to be able to bring up what would help them most, which was what I had to tell them. I had a seat way in the back, and now she would call on me if she didn't know if she liked me. I knew that. And the topic she had chosen that night was the difference between love and hate. Now, when I sat down in that chair, I knew the difference between love and hate, because I hated the leader, I hated my seat, I hated the topic, I hated the people over there at the meeting. I was filled with hate. And yet, as they started around the table, talking about the difference between love and hate, then to each and every one of them, went back to me, I didn't have anything to say. I think the reason is because I suddenly realized the leader hadn't changed, my seat hadn't changed, the topic hadn't changed, but my attitude towards it had changed. Now I began to look back and see how many things that I loved one and hated the next, and things that changed. The only thing that had changed was my attitude towards it, and that is what I try to work on, and that's why I think I discovered doing this, the 8th and the 9th steps, making the amends and noticing that my attitude towards something is what creates the necessity to make the amends. Because actually, if it hadn't been the fact that I was, unable to see myself as I really was, created that too, made it necessary for me to pay these various parts that I had paid until I had built up such a list of people that in reality I had harmed in one way or another. Being willing to make amends, they told me the most important part of that step is being willing is my chance of being able to do it. Willingness is a key to change, and willingness I had. I always put 10 steps in with the 8th and 9th because to me, continuing to take personal inventory when I'm wrong from the admit has made it possible for me to eliminate the necessity of making as many amends as I had to make before. Because I know what other people will never know about me. I know when I'm wrong. And being able to promptly admit it, that's one thing that I like in the 8th, 12th and 12th, is the fact that it says, now is when you admit you're wrong. You don't wait till next week, next month, or until you take the 8th and 9th step yet. If you're wrong, promptly admit it, it eliminates the necessity of trying to stay on an even keel as far as my life is concerned. And you know, it's kind of fun to call somebody on the phone that you've done something to or done something about or whatever, you are wrong, and have to admit. And here, the strange attitude that they have, they don't have to position. We, and the 8th that I heard in the time said that he had given quite a deal of thought to his first wife, he'd married about 7 times. And they used to have a sticker that said, you've been married to Jack Honk. And and he had He had got to think about his first wife, who had divorced him because of his drinking, and he got really honest and melancholy about it one day, and he realized, well, she was the mother of his children, and she had done his washing, and she had done his cooking, and she had done all these things that a wife's supposed to do, and he had treated her very badly, so possibly he did owe her immense. And so he called her on the phone and asked her if he could buy a steer, and she said yes, and he went over, and he made his demands to her. And he said, finally, it was going to shake her up as much as it did, I would have 10 years sooner, you know, because it does shake people up. Have you admitted that you're wrong, and be able to go on from there, because then nobody has any kind of power over you. You are your own. I'm just kind of like, you've got to understand. And I don't consider the 10th step to be similar to the 4th step. That's just my way. And I say that because sometimes people say, if you're 10 up here, you know more than somebody else. I don't. But for myself, the 10th step is something that I do on a daily basis. Making amends is something I do on a daily basis. Because it eliminates the necessity for me to have to live with some of the uncomfortable feelings I lived with before if I take care of it now. It works for me. I like the idea of, well, I've been talking between my own voice and what I haven't said, you know. But anyhow, if this is a repeat of Friday, I said out there. But I went to a woman one day and I said to her, I think that he's maybe drunk. And she said, I don't know. And I said, because he's working the road. And she said, I don't know he's working the road. And I said, because he's supposed to make amends and hasn't made any. And she said, I don't know he hasn't made any amends. And I said, because I've been available and he hasn't done anything. And she got up from where she was in and walked up to her desk and picked up pencils and pieces of paper. And she came back over and she put one of them in front of me and sat down with the other one. And she said, you know, now that you mention it, Russell hasn't made any amends to me either. So as long as you're here, I hope you and I make a list of the amends that we should make to them. So when they make their amends to us, we'll be ready. And I couldn't pick up a pencil. Because my mind began to go over the things I had done to him, you know. And hide in his car, switch his drawers, and back his beer. Yeah, I ran out of drugstore before he ran out of brands. You know, he'd taken the effect of Green Deer. Because my husband was sick of beer, and he'd drink anything, but beer was his drink choice. Had him convinced at one time it was an alcoholic beverage, because he said he did babies and do. I looked at the medical things that on a little baby has anesthesia. However, not the quantity he was drinking, that was a different. But anyway, I couldn't pick the pen. I couldn't make out any of those things. And she said to me, I can't lie down. I said, because if he finds out what I've really done to him, he'll divorce me. And she said, well, did it ever occur to you that he might have the same problem? And it occurred to me. Because, see, I was using the principles of this program to try to find out if he had really done all the things that I thought he had done. And I think that was the beginning of my being able to let go of the past, the drinking past. I don't want to know what he did, because I'm not sure that I have the stamina or the internal force to forgive him for things, or to forget things. And by the same token, I don't want him to know what I did either. I don't want to have to go to him and tell him some of the things that I did to him. And so I like the idea of making the amend by changing, by being able to take that 10th step. Take that 9th step, and take that 8th step, and work them all together, and that's the way I do it. It works for me. And that's pretty much the way I get Wilma work, too. She's one of those people that, I wish she'd come here with me, because on account of Alex and I have her speak for herself. And I tell her, most people listen to me, you're confused. And she said, why? And I said, because if I read a word out of my mouth, Wilma says. And she said, but I didn't do any big deal or any big thing as far as you're concerned. And no, when her husband was sick and passed away, she withdrew. She just changed completely. And she wouldn't go to me, she wouldn't let anybody in, she wouldn't have anything to do with that. And he actually called me on and he said, well, why don't you call them? Because if you call her, she'll figure you're in trouble, and if you're in trouble, she'll be glad to win. Because I have her kind of condition. And I said, okay, I'll give her a call and see what happens. And I called her, and she said I couldn't offer, so I went over. And I sat down with her, and I started to pitch at her some of the things that she had pitched at me over the years. And all of a sudden, the tears started to roll down her cheeks. And she said to me, I used to wonder where I got things that I said to you. And now I know that God gave them to me to give to you, so that you can take care of them until I need them. That, to me, is what this fellowship is all about. That, to me, is the reason that anybody who tries to use the 12 steps of AA that they've given permission to use has to improve, has to have that AA. But everything that was wrong with me is covered in those 12 steps. And I can only say that on a one-to-one basis because it's me that my life. It takes me right back to the first step. Takes me right to the second step. Takes me right to the first step. The 11th step, decision, wait a minute, I'm open to this one. It's fresh air. So I prepare meditation to improve, like my conscious conduct, God is then to promote from all of you who will for me the power to carry it out. That's exactly the way that it is in the book. But that's the way I have to work. Because when my mother was ill, God sent me an egg, I learned hate in 3 days, and that's a record. I say it possible, and she said it possible. And every so often, she'd look at me and she'd say, take the third step. And I said, I have. And a while later, she'd say, Winnie, please take the third step. And I said, I have taken the third step. Well, after about 2 days, that she said it once too often, and I flipped on her just like I have flipped on people all my life. And I said to her, Gloria, your problem is that you keep pounding off on the third step, and I'm really on the 11th. And so I repeated the both just in case she didn't know. And she was an A long before I ever got to Eleanor. I made a decision here, and I won my life over the care of God as I understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. And you know that all these years that I've heard people talk about these, I never believed anything in my life. I said, last night or maybe this morning or whenever it was, when Will gave me a job of tightening up that thing, I didn't even know how it felt. And yet when I repeated those two steps, Gloria, I heard from you for release. Because you see, I was always willing to turn my life over the care of God. I just wouldn't turn your life over the care of God. And when I put those two steps together, it finally brought home the idea that when I ask for help, that help has to be for me, not for you. I can ask God to help you. He has to help you on a direct basis. He can't do it through me. Because that's how he works. And it doesn't work that way in my life. My daughter was, I had so many manifestations of this one thing that I keep going back to every so often. But when I was saying all the troubles I made, it feels like I'm going out of style. I was sending candle fire insurance when I was at church. You know, and at first I would have some kind of a renewal or something. I was always in church praying, asking, what can I do? Tell me what to do. And sitting at the table one day, I said, I just don't understand why it isn't working. Look what I've done. Look at the prayer I've said. Look at the candle I've lit. Look at the things I've done. I still don't have an answer. And he said, the main reason you don't have an answer because you haven't got a problem. And it's true. It's also true that my sponsor used to say, The reason you have got the problem is because you are the answer because you haven't got the problem. See, I worry ahead. I don't wait until it happens. I try to be prepared so that if it happens, I take care of it. By the way, you know. And you say to me, God sent you a special delivery letter and told you to sail on Thursday and miracle come your way. You call him the phone and ask him to be guy because he doesn't do on Thursday. See? Because that's the way I am. Those are things I forget my own life. Now, I don't know what steps, probably cover them all. But with all these steps up to and including 12, it made me aware of what was going on. It made me aware of the fact that my problems never came from out there. My problems came from the inside. And my solutions also came from the inside. I like that idea that happiness is an inside job. Because many times it isn't what you say to me, it bothers me. It's why I think of it and you say it. That was something else we were talking about here a little earlier. My husband is one of them cheerful individuals. He's got faith and out of his ears. You know, and it just keeps going on and nothing bothers him. I do all the worrying. That's why my hair is this color. He doesn't have gray hair in his head. He said it's hereditary, but I think because it was reserved in alcohol for song. Once in a while, I would declare, let the good win today. Have you ever done that? When you just say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to do the dishes. I'm gonna, you know, nothing. And I'll read, especially if it's raining. I love to read when it rains. And I curl them and lay the whole day until like 4 to 5. And then it suddenly comes to me, it's going to be home at 15. And I have nothing. So I get up and I rush around and I try to get everything done in 15 minutes. Other people have been doing all day. And I'm worn out in 15 minutes. And he walks in with that cheerful attitude and says, what have you been doing all day? And I'm like, kill it. Because somebody says to me what I think of when he says it. And that's part of why I have great gifts also. In fact, I don't let what you say trigger something inside that I haven't taken care of that's going to last up my life. Because this is a save yourself program. They didn't say it exactly that way, but this is now, see, part of my success in Al-Anon, I believe, came from the fact that I believe everything I heard them say in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of those people that couldn't understand the Al-Anon. They were too nice to me. They were, you know, they were all of me. I was all eight. But I could go over there and I could hear these, because I don't know how it was when you can. And I'm not doubting Al-Anon. Don't get me wrong. I owe my life to those people. But I couldn't be that nice. And I knew I couldn't be that nice. I'd go over there and listen to them argue and fight and still be friends. They couldn't do that in Al-Anon. You had a fight in Al-Anon, there were sides. These friggin' folks. Now, maybe it's not way Oregon, but it was way in California. And I was always right in the middle. You know, I spent my life being in the middle. And I don't like being in the middle. See, I used to, Ed would tell me something about my kids' rule, he didn't like me, I'd say, I'll tell him about it. And then in my own way, I would say, so and so, I said, you should please don't do it when he's gonna know anything about it. And that may give him the freedom to go ahead and do it. And also gave him a hint that better not let him find out. And then they would say, I gotta take it, Mom. And I said, that's what I'd prefer to find out. I'll tell it. And then I'd say, you know how they are. These kids come to school, they just give them tips right left, whether they do anything or not, and they agree with me. And then take care of the tickets. All in the middle. I thought they were related. And one day I had a bother and stepped out of the middle and friends, I said, you know. And it was the same when I freaking out, and I was always in the middle. And it just because I didn't know enough about whether you were right or you were right. And so I tried to walk every narrow line. But in AA, that's where I found out that you can disagree agreeably without letting it become so big, so bad, that you can't get over it. One of the gross lessons I learned when I was doing Al-Anon was the fact that not everybody had worked as hard as I did to get this program. You see, I thought everybody that was there had worked as hard as I did in order to feel a little bit better and get a little bit better. But it's not that way. And the very first time that I heard somebody who I thought really loved say something I knew was absolutely positively wrong, I almost got dead. I said, she's not working for her. And I called her on the phone and I told her, I said, you know, that was an out-and-out lie. And Mom said, well, what difference does it make? And I said, she's been around so long, she should know better. And Mom said, well, you've been around for a while too, you don't know it better. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, I mean that you are guilty of judging her as she is of whatever she is. Two wrongs never made right. And from that time on, it was all right with me, no matter what she said or what I did. If that's what you thought, and that's how you felt, that's what you wanted to do, it was okay. And it worked out great. But all the women, and all of them, and I think that's right. I can play the same watch. I got 10 minutes more. I'll tell you, I'm going to step faster now than I ever did before. Anybody got any questions? I saw the cook mower and I thought it was being worse. I think, oh yeah, I'm sorry. Very close. Very close. In fact, it almost scary to see how close they are. You know, they fight. Don't sometimes. They disagree sometimes. They have disagreements. From the time they were able to get out and around, it was well known at school and anyplace else they were. They'd pick out one behavior like the other seven. And they still have the closeness, even today. You know, they get together for barbecues, they go places together, they buy things together, they do everything together. And I part of it is because somebody out, you know, the whole group make five more things they want to for their mind to. Yeah. No, you're not in the same boat. That's something I'm not content. I had somebody that also was co-pent, she called me. Every so often I'm going to talk to the Navy Hospital in Long Beach, and I know it's because I'm a classic example, but the Navy Hospital never ended up in the ranks of men. But I go because I have men's mate. And about you, they asked me to come down there. When I got to, she didn't call me, she called me a co-alcoholic. She didn't call me a co-dependent. She called me a co-alcoholic. They have with me. And so she had all this little form to watch for me. And I get off the elevator, and I'm just standing there, I didn't see that, and all these sailors and support and walking around. And this little form circled me a couple times before she came up and she said to me, are you a co-alholic? And I said, no, I'm not. And so she kind of backed off and circled me a couple more times. And then she came up and she said, what are you? And I said to her, I'm me. I said, I tell you who I am, but I can't tell you who I am. And I said, I'm Eddie. She said, you're a co-alholic. I said, no, I'm not. So when I started to talk at that meeting, she was sitting right in the front row. I said, I'm sorry for her. You know, because I had kind of thrown a salute, and that's making a man that just one made men's worse. I said, when I came down, I was a Siamese twin. And those females performed one of the most delicate, painful operations I have ever experienced when they separated me from him. And co-alcoholic to me makes me responsible for what he did in my mind. So I'm not a co-alcoholic. I don't wake him up with that. I will tell you that one of the reasons that they have some of these scientific medical type designations for us now is because if you are a co-dependent, or you are a co-alcoholic, or you are there's another one, co-dependent. Yeah, well, anyhow, if you are one of those, You can buy insurance. You see, and that is exactly where I came from. Uganda, they won't turn you into nuts. They will if you're a alcoholic. And it always kind of saddened me to see my pay or I would get a free charge for nothing. But it's just like it's necessary, you know. And if it's necessary, then that's important. I don't know anything that helps anybody. I don't care what it is. Because in the very beginning, when they first started talking about conference for literature, and I'll tell you very frankly, I was not all for conference for literature, because I thought it would kind of fence around your recovery by limiting you to what you could use and what would help you. And I remember at one of the interview meetings saying, if I walked into a 12-step hall and I handed a girl the face on the bar and floor, and I said to her, this is what helped me. If she believed me, it will help her too. Because it isn't what you read that helped me. It was what I read that helped me. It's what I shared that helped me. The only reading in the world is not going to come from the nature, at least for me. Because I've read just about anything and anything I get my hand on. The old that book always told me, you know, especially when the appendix out. Because I went to a meeting one day, and the format of the meeting was they had these little pieces of paper with, like they had love, and they had right going up God, and it was a piece of paper, and had numbers down there, and then after it was passed around, then the leader called off number, and the person who had that number took that saying, and talked about it. And I was sitting next to this little gal, and I was honking around, but I took my piece of paper, and she took hers, and she opened it, and she looked at it, she sucked it in her pocket, and she reached for the book. And I thought, well, what you got? You know, I mean, well, I didn't know, I was curious, so I said, what did you get? And she took a little piece of paper, and for me, on it, it said love. And I said to her, you're not going to love that book. That book helped explain to me what this evening is that I can't put a title to. It's love. But I can learn love by just reading my book. I don't care how many different pages I've got. None of them are ever going to cover that feeling. Because if you don't have a feeling, you don't know what you're talking about. This isn't a committed word of life that has to do with words. It has to do with feeling. And that's what works the way it does. But that's the way it works for me. It doesn't mean that makes anything wrong for anybody else. That's one of the things I think you have to come to terms with when it comes to the fellowship of AA or not. And that is you have the courage to reach out and find out what you're all about. And faith and the trust to allow it to happen. Whatever comes along, I don't know what it is. But I do know that by allowing myself to go with the flow, just like that river, I'll let it happen. Let it go. If I say that out of the way, it works. And I don't know how it works. And as I said many times, it was a true every time I said, if I ever find out how it works, I'll probably change it. Well, I'm telling you how they responded to me. They recognized almost immediately that when Wilma was around, I was different. And in the beginning, it was a lot of game. You know, she came, I would have to impress her with what I was working for. She was damn light. You know, I used to work at an hour and a half meetings, and from home, and they came, and she came over, like, over me, and everyone angel, that ass, you know. The kids recognized a change in me when she was around, and they responded to that change in me. No, I forget who I was talking to, but when my kids were small, you still thought I was the extension of me. They were sort of like publicity of how good mother I was. And so I used to try to make them do the right thing at the right time in the proper way and so forth. And I used to say to them, if I'm getting ready to go to a birthday party or something, you know, where we're going to be out with other people and so forth, my parting shot was always, remember who you are. And one day my oldest son, who was about 11 at the time that I came to Ellen, and one day I gave that little line to him, he turned around and looked at me right now, and he said, you know, Mom, sometimes you don't even know who you are. You see? But they recognized that in me. They more or less were smarter than I was all during that time. Because they did not allow me to disturb them to the point that I feel that they were harmed forever. You know, they still laugh about some of the things which embarrassed me a lot of times. Because usually it's Thanksgiving or something, you know, and that's the guy should have seen my horse came to Alma, and then they start, you know. And they remember a lot more about me before I came to Alma than I remember about me. But it's okay, you see, because we are a family who learn to laugh together about things we try about alone. And I'm part of the healing, you know. I've always thought Alateen was put into existence for my benefit, because I came to Alma in October 1957, and Alateen came to Alma in December of 1957. So I had two kids in the original group, you know. In fact, they drafted them. They wanted half your people, and so they asked me please to let them go, and they just loved it, you know. And I think I helped them too. But I don't believe the scars that possibly they had for my upbringing were so deep that they couldn't. You know, I think they had a natural resistance to me for some reason or other. One thing I did have to do after I got down was quit laying out their clothes. You know, early after that morning, today I had clothes for 8 kids. And we don't have stuff that. But I used to have color coordinated. You know, the shirts, pants, socks, everything had to be right. Eddie, too, I used to lay his clothes out. He's not colorblind, but he's got a thing about sides and flags that just drive me up a wall. They're together, you know. He used to be embarrassing to go places with him, and he looked like a circus clown. That's why he's calling. And so, Will said to me, they're going to have to quit dressing those kids. They're getting too many, with late 11, he's old. And, she's going to have to let them alone because you're making cripples out of them. They're going to be able to dress themselves if you don't like this off. And I said, well, I'll quit picking their clothes out. But so I have to quit picking these clothes out. She said, yes, you do. And I said, well, what about stacks in the pad? And she said, he's got them on. If you let it back, you your problem, not his. So one day, my oldest son, my youngest son, George, came home from school. This is quite why I quit helping him. And he was mad in the way. And he said, I had on two different socks today. And I said, well, I'm sorry, George, but I guess you're just going to have to get up earlier and get them matched up if that's what happened in your hair life. And that was about all it was said. And a few weeks, months, or times, I don't know how long after that. But we were sitting at the table after discussing things, and I was trying to explain something to my son Donald, which was one of the twins. And I used George as an example. I said, just like George, wearing two different socks to school. I said, George, you don't wear two different socks to school, do you? He says, not unless I wear my boots. Now he learned that himself. I never whip up the boots, I just got on two different socks. So I think that the kids grow in spite of it, not because of it. And that's absurd. No, God protects school and children. Both of us. Okay. Let's
this is the end of session 4, the start of session 5.
Okay, because, you know, I guess you're supposed to do this, well, this study, I should be a little more, I should really be a little more sedate. For me, that's slip, you know, when I begin to think I should eat something. I usually get into trouble, but God always sent me an Eskimo. This morning, he sent Raven over, and he looked, and she said, oh, is that hot? And I said, yes. I was unaware, but I, you know, I was a little risque. She said, well, I think I'm still a little bit, you know, that. Well, we're now at 12 step, which is one of my favorites. And I don't even notice the sweater that I had on. Well, step 12. Having had spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice principles in all our affairs. And they gave me that one of those a long time ago, and it was embroidered. And it was embroidered for me because I couldn't remember the darn thing. You know, there was some sort of mental block there. As I told you the other night or the other day or whenever, I was one of those people that came in, got an inkling of what was going on, and went right into 12 step. Because it just, for one thing, can't even have to do the rest of them steps. And I was meeting a lot of people. We're in worship now, us. That always helps too. You know, you can find, I think it's in the 20 questions where they ask you, do you seek the Lord's companion? And I always did, see. I wanted to find people that are in worship now, because I would find an excuse for not doing some of the things Will told me I had to do. Now, figure that one out. You can give somebody an answer in November. But anyhow, I would make a bus call any time of the day or night, you know. And this one particular day, I was having my own script page. I don't even know what it was that was bothering me. But the telephone rang, it was a office. She had a call in my area, and she wondered, would I accept a call? And I said, why, certainly, of course, I had my own storage bin of literature, you know. And I go in time, and she gave me the address, and when I hung up the phone, the strange thing happened to me, the same thing that had happened many, many times before that I had not been aware of it. There was a transition from the first page I accepted to being sort of like an evangelist. I was about to carry the message. And I got in my car and drove over to this girl's house, and when she opened the door, it was almost like sitting in my past. She had her hair halfway tied up with a bandana, and she had two little kids kind of half-hiding behind her. And she wasn't sure when she opened the door whether she was going to let me in or not. And but she did, and she took me into the living room, and her mother was sitting there. It looked like we were on a week. I mean, you know, we were all so solemn and so serious, but I was being drunk. And and he started talking to me, keep saying, don't get all this, don't get all this. And all of a sudden, the girl put her around there, and she said, Mother, please, how do I know what I'm going to say until I heard what I said? And I understood that. Well, it's kind of strange, you know, right away, because a lot of things I didn't understand that I heard. But I stayed for about an hour, and I did share my experience strength and hope with her. What I shared with her was what I had heard other people say at meetings, which was their experience strength and hope. And when I walked out the door, she put her arms around me and gave me a hug and thanked me for coming, and she said to me, I feel so much better. Thank you for coming. I walked out in the car, closed the door, and was back in my own stroke bed. The transition had been complete. I had gone back. I started the car, headed for home, and all of a sudden I heard what she said. Thank you for coming. I feel so much better. And I was immediately mad at her. Why should she feel better? I'm the one that carried the message, and I don't feel any better. And I don't know, have you ever sort of had something through your head like there was somebody whispering in your ear? And all of a sudden I heard this voice or whatever say, she believed you.